All rise. The judges of the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals draw near, for the court is now in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Please take your seats. The court is called to order. Are both sides ready to argue?
Defense is ready, Your Honor.
The government is ready.
And we're here to hear the case of the United States versus Amber First Class Saldana. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And I understand, Mr. Casari, you'd like 5 minutes of reserve?
Yes, Your Honor.
You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning.
Good morning.
If it pleases the court, I'm going to have to fix an old habit and project my voice a little bit further than I used to in the old courtroom, and I hope you all will be able to hear me. It's a pleasure to be back before the court and to be here in this very impressive and very beautiful building. Your Honor, as you said, we are here to decide the case of United States versus Saldana. Defense has two contentions in this case. The first is that the government failed to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the appellant intentionally inflicted injuries on Dustin Marine, and the evidence failed to prove that appellant couldn't, and the evidence proved that appellant could not and did not inflict these injuries. The second issue is that the president of the panel failed to disclose that he had training as a military magistrate. This omission was exacerbated when the assistant trial counsel sat by when he knew or should have known that Colonel Cherrick did not answer truthfully and that the convening authority ignored the Court of Military Appeals precedents in United States versus Mack and refused to order a post-trial Article 39A session while ordering one on an issue that benefited the prosecution. And if it pleases the court, what I would like to do is to address issue number two first. And I actually mentioned it to my opposing counsel this morning. She said that was her intention as well. So
all right.
We would like to start with issue number two. And we believe in the appellant believes in this case it would be very helpful to look at the chronological history regarding issue number two. And the first thing that the court will note is that the panel president was asked by the military judge very pointed questions on voir dire. And those questions include, do you have any specialized legal training? Do you have any specialized law enforcement training? And have you had any involvement with either side that may affect your ability to sit in this court-martial? Colonel Cherrick, the president of the panel, answered all of those questions in the negative. The defense counsel, who were not stationed at Buckley, and we believe that that's important in this case because they would have no reason to know that Colonel Cherrick was the assistant military magistrate at Buckley Air Force Base. They learned post-trial, and it's not clear on the record how, and we'll talk about that in a little bit, that Colonel Cherrick was indeed the alternate magistrate and, in fact, had received not only specialized legal training in that area, but, and again, we believe very importantly, had issued a search authorization in a case in which the assistant trial counsel was in the room while he was briefed by another trial counsel as to the necessity for a search authorization to issue. So clearly, two people and only two people in that courtroom knew that Colonel Cherrick had presided or had served as a military magistrate and had such training. Now again, Your Honors, after trial, the defense learns of this information, and again, it's not clear how, and they ask for a post-trial 39A. The convening authority denied this. But what the defense believes is extremely important in this case is that, as the court knows from the record, the convening authority did order a post-trial 39A to sort of perfect the findings as they had been improperly announced during the court-martial. The military judge, we believe properly, saying that the record had been authenticated, did not expand the findings of that. Well, actually, we're going to get into that in a second. But he did not expand the scope of the 39A to include the panel member's failure to answer truthfully. Defense counsel, therefore, addresses the matter only in their post-trial 1105 matters. And as the court is also aware, the defense asked to attach certain relevant documents to the record of trial, and the military judge refused to do so. So to some degree, and we'll address that in a little bit, this court is operating in the dark, and we're going to explain how we believe this court can remedy that. The Court of Military Appeals set out the framework in a case very similar to this one and ordered a debate hearing in the case of United States v. Mack. And that member, a panel member, failed to disclose that he was the victim of a robbery some 30 years earlier. And if the court remembers how that came up in the Mack case, he served as a panel member, didn't disclose anything, served as a panel member in a second case, and disclosed it, and then there was a debate hearing to understand why he had not disclosed that during the first case. And at that point, the then Army Court of Military Review stated, while we are reluctant to attribute the panel member's failure to disclose to dishonesty, it is apparent that he did not reveal material information. And they said, quite frankly, that it is unlikely that he forgot. Well, the appellant would propose that if the panel member in Mack, if the facts in Mack warranted further fact-finding, and if the panel member in Mack was not honest, then Colonel Cherry's conduct in this case, quite frankly and quite disturbingly, is significantly worse. And we'll explain that. In the Stanley case, the robbery that Colonel Stanley had been a victim of was 30 years prior. Now, there's not much in the Mack case that tells us what that robbery was about, but he was asked the usual question, have any of you been a victim of a violent crime? He answered no. And it turns out he had been a victim of a robbery 30 years earlier. And when asked in the second court-martial, why didn't you disclose that in the first court-martial, he said, you know, it just sort of occurred to me as I was doing the second court-martial that I should probably mention that. In this case, Colonel Cherrick's training as a magistrate was 18 months before trial. And even more importantly, 7 months before appellant's trial, he had issued a search authorization. He had served. He's actually carrying out his duties as a military magistrate in a case in which the assistant trial counsel was in the room when he was briefed. There is simply, quite simply, members of the court, no way to conclude that Colonel Cherrick did not receive specialized legal training.
Okay, counsel, what difference would it have made? Let's say he had admitted it during the voir dire and said, yes, I've received training as a magistrate. Would that have disqualified him as a matter of law from sitting on this panel?
We believe it was, Your Honor. I'm getting to that point in about 2 seconds.
All right.
Okay? And, Your Honor, I apologize. The court podium here is actually, my vision is not real good. So would the court mind if I put something underneath there, if I just grab a book and put it underneath? I literally can't read my notes. I do apologize for that interruption. That is much better. It's got new glasses. And they're
okay.
Causing me some trouble. What we do know in this case is sufficient for this court to rule. However, if the court decides it does not have sufficient information, then the Mack case and the Supreme Court case of McDonough Power both say that this court can order a fact-finding hearing either by sending it back to the convening authority for a post-trial 39A or to expand the post-trial 39A that was previously ordered, or to order a Dubé hearing. But here is what we know. He was asked very pointed questions, and Your Honor, this is going to get to your question. These questions were sufficient for two things to have happened. One, or three things, really. One is for the defense counsel to explore further. What is the nature of that training? You know, we all know that it is different from base to base. I have trained military magistrates. I'm sure the members of the court have trained military magistrates. That training may change from base to base. We don't know what training Colonel Cherrick revealed. The other question that a prudent defense counsel, and we believe the defense counsel in this case were extremely sharp, would have asked him is to explore the difference between the different standards of proof between a military magistrate's duties and a court-martial panel member to make sure that he understood that difference between a beyond a reasonable doubt and a preponderance of the evidence. We believe that this, we have also explored his close relationship with the government and the prior briefing with the assistant trial counsel. We believe that these matters, in and of themselves, based on the information that we have, would have led to a challenge for actual bias, and given the liberal grant mandate from CAF, that challenge would have been granted. We also believe that it would lead to a challenge based on implied bias. And here's why. The average observer would equate a military magistrate with being a member of the prosecution team. If you ask most people in the civilian community, What does a magistrate do? Well, they're sort of a judge. I think that most people would agree with that, that they have a greater knowledge of the court-martial system than your average panel member, that they're an important part of the military justice system. And perhaps most importantly in this case, that he had knowledge before trial and had worked with the assistant trial counsel on a prior case. Now, two times in this last term, CAF has encouraged the defense to file for a post-trial 39A session. Remember, those are the Huff case, and I think it's the Lofton or Lufton case. And here, the defense did exactly what they were supposed to do. They didn't just sit idly by. When they found out about this information, they immediately requested a post-trial 39A session, and the convening authority denied. Again, somewhat disturbingly, he ordered a post-trial 39A session for the very limited purpose, which was to perfect the findings against the accused. As your court remembers, they announced the findings to a specification, not to the charge. They had to go back in and re-announce the findings. The defense counsel then, in front of the military judge, requested yet again to expand the scope of that hearing to determine whether or not Colonel Cherik's answers were untruthful and to do further fact-finding, and the military judge refused. It is also, the defense believes, important to note that the military magistrate, the president of the panel, was not an idle observer during this post-trial 39A. In fact, he is the one that announced the findings of the court and had probably had more lines during this court-martial than during the post-trial 39A than anybody but the military judge. And yet, both the convening authority and the military judge refused to allow any questions with regards to whether or not he should have been challenged, could have been challenged, during appellant's court-martial. Your Honors, I'd like to post a quick analogy, and then I'll end this issue and move on to the factual and legal sufficiency. The appellant believes, that if post-trial they had obtained evidence that any of the parties of the case, a defense counsel, a trial counsel, a military judge, had never been properly sworn or certified under Article 27 Alpha or Bravo, that they, you know, we had a slew of cases in the Army a few years ago where military judges had not, had let bar membership lapse and were not active members of the bar. The defense believes that if this information had come to the defense's attention, that the military judge would have had the authority and, in fact, the responsibility to inquire of that matter at a post-trial 39A. Whether the convening authority limits the scope of the 39A is somewhat irrelevant in the appellant's view. The important issue is that if information regarding a structural defect to this court-martial comes to the attention of either the convening authority and or the military judge, and in this case both, that they have an obligation under the law to explore that matter. And we believe that this court should take that further and send this case back to the convening authority for a post-trial 39A if the court believes that there is not enough information on the record to reverse the findings. Members of the court,
let's assume that the colonel was untruthful, because I believe he is untruthful. I mean, he got the training, he didn't admit it. What do we do with that?
If this court believes, without any further information, that Colonel Cherik was untruthful, then I believe that the appropriate remedy is a reversal. Because, Your Honor, it is no different than if an implied bias or an actual bias grant, the challenge had not been granted. There is simply no difference. If this court finds, for example, that a panel member, you know, should have, the military judge should have granted a challenge for cause against a panel member.
I'm using
this by analogy, Judge.
Okay.
You don't send it back for a post-trial 39A to say, well, what other questions might you have asked? What role did that person have? The proper remedy is to reverse the charges and order a new trial. I would argue that in this case, when it is clear that a challenge for cause would have been granted against Colonel Cherik, that the remedy is the same. But the fallback remedy, should this court disagree, and I've learned over the years of doing appellate work that courts don't always agree with me, should this court disagree, then we believe that the appropriate remedy would be to send the case back to the convening authority for a post-trial 39A or to order a debate hearing. We believe that Mack and McDonough Power authorize either one of those remedies.
Counsel, what's the difference between a magistrate's role and a commander's role? Because I think the question was interrelated. Have you received any additional legal training that is not that is beyond what you would have received as a commander with respect to a magistrate's role in authorizing search authority, probable cause determinations, and a commander who has basically the same role with respect to the sphere of influence that he has? What's the difference?
The issue, Your Honor, I believe that there's a difference for a couple of reasons. First off, the military magistrate also has additional duties, such as pretrial confinement, things that a commander does not have.
But that's not applicable in this case, so how does that...
Well, we don't know if it's applicable, Judge, because we don't know what training he had, and we don't know what his role was as a military magistrate.
We don't have pretrial confinement as an issue in this case, so what difference would that have made with respect to Saldana?
My point, Your Honor, is that you said that he has the same powers as a commander. I'm saying, no, we don't know that to be the case, because a military magistrate does have additional powers that a commander would not have.
Well, a commander can order one of his troops into confinement, not necessarily to keep him there with 305 stuff, but what's the difference? I guess what I'm getting at.
Right. And my point is the difference, A, is that the military magistrate has extensive powers that a commander doesn't have. I'm trying to think of the right word, Your Honor. Difference B is that the military magistrate receives a significant amount of training, or we believe he does. We don't know that in this case, but we believe that he receives a significant amount of training that a commander does not receive in deciding. In fact, I think we all know from our ways of the world, when a commander wants to issue a magistrate, he calls his trial counsel and says, what do I need to do? And the trial counsel says, well, you need to make a determination of whether or not you think there's probable cause based on these factors. Okay, I do or I don't, and he moves on. Whereas we all know that a magistrate is going to receive extensive amounts of training that a commander does not have. Whether that happened in this case, Judge, we simply don't know. Your Honor, I think that the important point in this case is this. The military justice system prides itself on its openness and its perception of fairness. And yet, when faced with the best opportunity to resolve these issues at trial, the government decides to simply sweep it under the rug and hope that nobody is looking. We're not going to expand the post-trial 39A to look into these matters, and we're going to oppose any effort by the military judge to expand the scope of the 39A.
Well, at this point, do you have any evidence that the colonel was being dishonest?
Your Honor, I would point to the language in Mack, in which the then Court of Military Review said, we're somewhat loath to call him dishonest, but it's clear that he did not...
So his answer's not correct. We got that.
Yeah. And so, you know, no, we don't have any information that he wasn't dishonest because there was no post-trial 39A. Is Colonel Cherrick going to get up and say, I lied? I don't know the answer to that, Judge. But that's why we believe the defense did the appropriate thing in this case and said, let's hold a post-trial 39A and find out from Colonel Cherrick himself. I don't even know if Colonel Cherrick's still on active duty, Judge. I know nothing about Colonel Cherrick outside of what is in this record of trial.
Well, did defense counsel have the opportunity to ask him?
You mean to ask him outside of the confines of that post-trial 39A?
Sure.
Well, I suppose they did, Your Honor, but that's certainly not the preferred solution to this matter that has been enunciated by Mack and McDonough Power. I mean, just as the government could have asked him, I don't think that's their responsibility. And in fact, panel members are, you know the oath that panel members are given. My experience is panel members are somewhat loath to talk to prosecution or defense counsel, and certainly about a substantive matter such as, why didn't you disclose this? And I guess theoretically, Your Honor, there's also the additional problem, you'd have to read him his rights first if you suspect him of making a false official statement. So as I'm speaking, I'm thinking why that's not really a good idea and why it wouldn't have worked in this case, Judge.
Okay.
Subject to any, Your Honor?
Well, I don't want to...
We believe that the information on factual sufficiency is well developed in the record.
Okay.
I just need a few minutes on that.
As you point out in your brief, it's a two-step process. One, did he fail to answer honestly a material question? And then two, basically, what prejudice would that have caused? Let's say, because if he comes back and he says, well, I lied. Obviously, that's a different issue. But if we do a debate hearing and he comes back and says, I either forgot 18 months ago, I've only done it a couple of times, mistake on my part, sorry about that, or didn't equate necessarily magistrate's training with law enforcement training, what do we do with that? I mean, let's just say that's what happens. And
sure.
All we've got is, okay, I did receive this training, but it had no effect on my sitting as a member. Where's the prejudice?
Okay, I think there's prejudice in a couple of different areas, Your Honor. First off, I don't want to lose track of the fact that there's an assistant trial counsel in the court who has an independent duty to stand up and say something. Okay? That did not happen in this case. So while we believe Colonel Cherrick deserves a significant amount of the blame in this case, we think that there's sufficient blame to go around for the assistant trial counsel as well. But to the pointed answer to your question, Judge, I think it's set up for two things. First off, for whoever is doing either the post-trial 39A or the debate hearing to make an independent credibility determination as to whether Colonel Cherrick is being candid. And two, for the defense counsel to say, based on the information, had we known it at the time, this is what we would have done. But frankly, if the answer simply is, I forgot and I would have never told anybody under any circumstances, then we believe the appropriate remedy is reversal. Because we believe that he was statutorily barred, or at least not statutorily barred, but that he was barred from sitting on this court-martial because the defense would have challenged him,
okay.
And that challenge
Let's
would have been granted.
Do you believe that there, under the law, there's a requirement that as a magistrate versus being a court, as a commander, which we know there is no per se requirement that you cannot sit as a commander,
right.
But as a magistrate, you would argue as a matter of law, either through implied bias or actual bias, he would have been dismissed just by the fact that he had that position?
I'll answer that question two ways.
Okay.
One is, I misspoke when I said there was a statutory bar. That is not what I meant to imply. We do believe that there is no, that the role of a military magistrate would not per se disqualify somebody. Okay? However, the information that we now have about this case, even a little bit that we have, including the fact that the assistant trial counsel had participated in a briefing with him, would have certainly led to a grant for implied bias, and we believe for actual bias as well. Members of the court, I just have a couple of minutes, but I wanted to get the most important issue and the more difficult issue to resolve out quickly. Your Honor, the government failed to prove the appellant was responsible for these injuries, and if he did so, and if he was responsible, that he did so intentionally. We're just going to point to two areas where, yes, Your Honor.
Yeah, I did. Are you saying all three injuries or just the bottom?
When you say all three, two to an arm, one to
the arm, the leg,
and the head.
And the mouth.
Well, he was convicted of the mouth.
Right.
So
he was convicted of all.
Well, I was convicted of all. We didn't brief the mouth, is what I meant to say. No.
Right.
We are not contesting the validity of the conviction of the mouth.
Okay. That's what I want to make sure.
You know, the accused admitted that he, of course he was convicted of all three, or I would have stayed home this week. Your Honors, I just want to point to two areas that I would like this court to look at when they review this case. Okay? The leg and the arm injuries, the timing given by the experts was that those injuries most likely occurred 7 to 10 days prior to 4 January. Now, what do we know about that time frame that's important? We know two things. We know that, number one, the appellant and his wife were the part-time babysitters for the first week that the child was in of that two-week period. I think they started sitting on 16, and then sometime around New Year's Eve, they became the full-time babysitters, basically. But for that first week of that 14-day period, and concentrating specifically on the 7 to 10-day period, there is simply nothing in the record of trial about what contact, if any, the appellant had with the child. Okay, that's issue one. Issue two is that in the 24 hours prior to the child, the examination of the child, the appellant, and when the injuries to the head most likely occurred, according to the medical testimony, the appellant had no contact with the child. So the two significant injuries that we are dealing with here happened at times when either the appellant had, we believe, very little contact, but there's nothing in the record that really tells us what contact, if any, he had with the child, and the head injuries, when he had absolutely no contact with the child during that 24-hour period. We also know this, Your Honors. We know that 24 hours prior to the child being brought to the doctor and these injuries diagnosed, he had a thorough examination by Dr. Fromchek at the urgent care. And the government tried to downplay that significantly in their closing argument and say, well, it wasn't a thorough examination. But his mother, who brought the child to the doctor, said he looked at his head, he examined his head, he examined the back of his head. In fact, the back of his head was facing him when he walked in. And he noticed no injuries to the head. Why? Because as the doctors told you, there is a 0 to 24 hour time frame for those injuries to have most likely occurred. Now, this is certainly not to a medical certainty. Nobody knows that. But what the panel had to go on was a 0 to 24 hour time frame was the most likely explanation as to when those bruises to the head occurred. And we know that at that time frame, the appellant had zero contact with this child. And again, it's helpful to look at the chronology. On 4 January, the injuries are noted. The outside scope as to how old these injuries could have been was 14 days. During that period, Dustin was with numerous other babysitters, friends, etc. During the first week of that two-week period, he spent very little time, if any, alone with the accused while he was in the Saldana home. And we know this for two reasons. And this is an interesting case because as this court conducts its factual sufficiency, the government, you know, we are normally left. I was expecting something high tech. I was expecting an arrow up here. I'm sorry. Kind of caught me off guard there, Judge. We know that we have a video in this case. We don't have that in most of our cases. So when this court has the opportunity to conduct its factual sufficiency review, I would encourage the court to look at that video, and you will see the appellant's explanation as to how, you know, he's grasping for straws. He's sitting there going, I don't know what could have happened, but maybe it was this. And then you compare that to the medical evidence, and actually his explanations really don't match up to the medical evidence.
How should we take the fact that when the detective, in this very video interview, comes in and 5 minutes into the interview, puts down his report or whatever he actually had in his hand and says, this investigation shows categorically that you were responsible for the injuries caused, and I just need to figure out if it was done by because you were angry or you were trying to hurt the baby. The appellant doesn't deny it right off the bat, doesn't say, what are you talking about? I couldn't have done that. He just basically says, all right, I understand.
Well, I don't think he says, right, I understand. Yeah, he says, look, I know that you're here to find out what happened. And he is sitting there over and over again trying to come up with some scenario. I mean, he's basically trying to point the finger at himself. He's saying, maybe it was this, maybe it was this. You know, Court, Your Honors, I will close with this. I would ask this court to use your knowledge and ways of the world. I have a 19-year-old son. You put him in the room with an experienced detective, he'll admit that he was on the grassy knoll the day JFK was shot. I mean, this kid is being bruised and battered by an experienced detective trained in all of these interrogation techniques, and he never admits to anything besides the one charge that we are not contesting, which is that he injured this child's mouth. Subject to any further questions from the court, that concludes my presentation until rebuttal.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Please, the court. Your Honors, I'm Lieutenant Colonel Linnell LaTendra, and along with Colonel Don Christensen, we represent the United States in this matter. And today, as appellant has already mentioned, we will start with the second issue, that being the issue of voir dire. And the appellant is not entitled to either a rehearing or a Dubay hearing in this matter because he has failed to provide and to meet his burden. His burden is twofold. First, as the Supreme Court laid out, the appellant must demonstrate that the member failed to answer a question honestly.
How do we know that? We haven't had a hearing to determine why he didn't answer a question, which he obviously had some type of specialized training. So how do we know that?
I think it's important because we can look at what is before this court in the record of trial. And first, we should very closely look at the question that was actually asked. The question that was asked on page 104 of the record is as follows. Has anyone had any legal training or experience other than generally received by rank or position? Now, Your Honors, the government would suggest that this court should not find any dishonesty or lying on the part of the member. And instead, this court should follow the example put forward by Modesto when our Superior Court said that we should be reluctant, absent unusual circumstances, to conclude that a member has not been forthright. And in looking specifically at this question that he was asked, should be looking at this through a reasonable person. The reasonable member sitting there does not equate military magistrate training with legal training. And the reason is...
That's what you say. How do we know that? Why don't we send this back for a hearing to determine from the individual who had to make that decision when he's asked that very question?
Because our superior courts have not sent similar questions back for rehearings to ascertain what that specific member had in his actual mind when he was asked questions. For example, in Modesto, that president, a general officer, was asked some questions regarding whether or not he had ever been in a skit involving or seen a skit involving a male officer or enlisted person who dressed as a female. There was clearly, through the scope of voir dire, a question about males dressing as females as the issue that the defense counsel was trying to ascertain. The general officer said no, never seen a skit. But later there was evidence put forward that he himself had dressed as a woman at a party. And our court, Superior Court, found that in looking at that, we hold and look at the actual question that he was asked. Was he asked a specific question that would have elicited an affirmative response? And asking a generalized question about legal training does not elicit an affirmative response when all he's received is magistrate training.
So you don't consider this specialized law enforcement training?
No, Your Honor. This is magistrate training because he was asked about legal training that is different from someone of his rank and position. It would be as if an individual who's received ethics training or law of armed conflict training being asked, have you received legal training? No, I received ethics training. I received magistrate training. No one ever asked him a question about being a magistrate. And it's important for Your Honors to remember that it's very clear to the appellant and appellant's counsel that he is a group commander. He is a group commander who, and in oftentimes we have appointed military magistrates who are our group commanders. And no question was asked by the defense counsel as to whether or not he had any specialized responsibilities as a result of his group commander, other than those involving his issues as a medical group commander. And those issues involving the Central Registry Board or the FMS.
Well, how do you differentiate appellant's counsel's reliance on the MAC case?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
In this situation.
In MAC, the specific question was asked. If Your Honors look at MAC, the president of that board was asked if he had ever experienced or been a part of an assault, of a violent assault. He was also individually voir dired on this very issue, and he chose to talk about someone he knew, a friend. Later, it was found out through a different court-martial that this actual president was the victim of a violent assault at gunpoint. He was tied up. He thought he was going to be killed. He actually testified in a court-martial and at sentencing against the individual who did this to him. And the court noted that it was unlikely that the member forgot that he was a victim of an assault at gunpoint. This is very different here. When an individual receives a total of 6 pages of material on military on how to be a military magistrate, and another 26 slides, those slides are within the materials that this court has before them through the clemency matters that the appellant put forward.
What's the harm in sending this back just to make sure that your conjecture is correct?
The harm, Your Honor, actually is, well, first out of judicial economy, but second, because it's the appellant's burden, not only to show that there was dishonesty here, but second, they failed the second prong laid out by the Supreme Court. Because even if we sent this back and the president got up and said, absolutely, I lied, which the government does not believe in any way, looking at the very honest answering that this member gave throughout his individual voir dire, and you can look at his specific responses to medical questions in that regard on page 121 to 125 of the record. But the appellant fails the second thing. So even if we sent this back for a Dubé hearing and came back, there is no actual or implied bias in this case. And we know that by looking not only at what the public might believe in the fact.
If he lied, there's no actual bias? If he sat on this because I wanted to sit on this court-martial and I'm not going to let the defense know that I've been a magistrate, you don't think there's actual bias?
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe that there's a lie here. He was never asked if he was a magistrate.
But we don't know that. I mean, you're making an assumption that he didn't lie. And maybe there's nothing in the evidence to show that he lied. Maybe he misunderstood. That's probably what happened.
Well, actually,
but we're dealing with a probably versus we can send this back to clarify something that we don't know. What's the harm in that? Just to make sure that the appellant, in fact, got a fair trial by an unbiased individual.
Well, first, I don't think that this would be going against court precedent in saying that we should assume that he's lying or sending it back, because our superior courts have been very clear that we should not make that sort of assumption. And in looking at these issues here, the second part of that question, even if he was just confused about is this legal training, the second part of the question is important. It wasn't just tell me everything, every legal training you've ever had. It was, have you ever had legal training that differs from someone of your similar rank and position? Group commanders are made military magistrates. This is not different than his rank or position, commensurate with any experience that he's had, and this court should not find any dishonesty based on the record that we have before us.
What do you say to the appellant's argument that being a magistrate is in fact different than being a commander with respect to authorities?
Well, Your Honor, I think we could actually look at the evidence that this court has and the training that he did receive, that the magistrate is taught and instructed to be neutral and detached. That if we were looking at it through an implied bias, through the public's perception of what the fairness of the military justice system, what we would see through the public's eyes is someone who received training on how to be fair. Impartiality is mentioned no fewer than 7 times in those materials that he received. He was also instructed in those materials to review evidence carefully, to listen to legal guidance, in other words, to listen to a military judge. The president himself indicated that he would do such a thing when he was specifically asked about questions regarding his medical background and expertise. He told the military judge, when the appellant asked very specific questions about his background, that he would be able to listen to expert testimony, that he would be able to listen to the instructions of the judge. That, combined with the idea that we are training someone as a military magistrate to be fair, to be impartial, and to review all the evidence in a neutral and detached manner, would lead the public to believe that there is no concern about fairness. This court could also look at United States versus Evans, in which case the member there received 4 weeks of legal officer training at the Naval JAG School, extensive experience on criminal law, procedure, and evidence, actually was the government representative in not one but two administrative boards. And that member was found by this court that that would not cause any sort of implied bias on the part of the public.
Was that member specifically asked if they had specialized legal training, and they answered yes? Did they affirmatively answer yes to that question?
They did affirm. That member did affirmatively answer yes to have you had specialized legal training. And there, an affirmative response is absolutely the forthright thing to do, because that person attended a training entitled Legal Officer Training in residence for 4 weeks. Whereas here, Your Honor, this individual received a packet of slides and received some paperwork that's entitled Military Magistrate Training, not legal training. And that training is no different than other individuals who in his similar rank and position.
I have one other question. Could you clarify for me the role of the assistant trial counsel in the briefings that the panel member received as a magistrate? Because opposing counsel has spent some time on that issue.
Yes, Your Honor. If this court is, those materials are contained, again, in the clemency that was submitted by the appellant, and so it is contained in the first volume of the record of trial. And in looking at that, from the discovery requests and answers, it is clear that the assistant trial counsel sat and listened to part of the training, and then also sat and listened to one particular search authorization. He was not the individual who was actually giving advice in this particular matter, but instead was, for all accounts, a witness. I think that's also important. That goes to the first issue that this court is looking at, that of whether or not there was any amount of dishonesty, because the trial counsel himself didn't see this question as calling for an affirmative response. Even lawyers in looking at this issue who were sitting here did not look at military magistrate training as some sort of legal training outside of the rank and position.
To repeat myself, counsel, that's assuming what you want to have the outcome be. We don't know what he thought. I mean, again, I'm kind of looking at, we're assuming he was not dishonest, and hopefully he was not, but we can't really determine that until we get an affirmative answer from him as to why he did not answer the question of have you received specialized legal training.
And I guess I would direct this court to the cases that have decided to remand for a Dubé hearing and those that have not. Mack, they did remand for a Dubé hearing, and they went through three reasons why they were doing that in that case. First, they had a hard time believing that a member just forgot that he was the victim of an assault at gunpoint and was tied up, fearful for his life. Second, the rot actually showed in that case, because there was also this other rot that was provided in this rot showing this president's other testimony there, that they were able to send this back to ascertain, did this person just forget, or was he intentionally dishonest here? In addition, mainly it was revolving around this idea that he was unlikely to forget. But when the court has looked at issues where the question isn't exactly on point, so for example, in United States versus Ruiz, when an individual was asked about his position about sexual harassment, the court looked at the questions that were asked, and when it was later discovered that his wife was the victim of sexual harassment, the court said, well, you know, that's not what this case was about. And that's not the actual question that he was asked. And therefore, we don't need to send this back for a Dubé hearing here. Here, there was no search authorization in this case. There is no military magistrate associated with this case. The facts of this case have nothing to do with the question that was asked about the legal training. And therefore, this court should not be remanding this back for a Dubay hearing, because the answer back would only satisfy, if we did get one of the questions before this court. And there is no actual or implied bias here, and therefore the court does not need to return this case back to trial. I would also point this court's direction and to some quotes from the Supreme Court as well as our Superior Court. It is virtually impossible to shield jurors from every contact or influence that might theoretically affect their vote. Due process means a jury capable and willing to decide a case solely on the evidence before it. And you have before you a record of trial that clearly shows a president who is willing to do just that. You can look directly when he was asked a question specifically related to his training or expertise. When he was asked on page 117 of the record by appellant's counsel about training in first aid or urgent care beyond what an airman receives in during their annual training, there he was asked a specific question in which the answer was clearly affirmative. He gave that answer. He then explained his unique urgent medical care training that he received prior to being deployed as a medical professional to both Iraq and Afghanistan, and then went on to explain to the military judge that he would give a fair and impartial hearing, listening to the experts in this case and the instructions of the military judge. Therefore, this court should not find that the appellant has met his burden on either prong of the McDonough test. If there are no further questions on the first issue, or on the second issue, I'll return to the first, on legal and factual sufficiency.
Okay.
In looking at the issue of legal and factual sufficiency, I'd like to clarify some of the issues or assertions made by appellant here today. First, the assertion that the record somehow says that the arm and leg occurred 7 to 10 days prior. That is not what the record here shows. In fact, what the record shows, the only time that 7 to 10 days is mentioned is by the expert in child abuse. She indicates that bones actually start to heal 7 to 10 days after or following a fracture injury. The radiologist said that it was anywhere between 0 and 14 days. The child abuse expert said 7 to 10. She said no such healing has occurred here. Therefore, we know that this injury took place somewhere within a 7 to 10 day. But we know even more than that with respect to the timeline based on the testimony that was given. Appellant himself, along with the child's mother and along with appellant's wife, indicated that on Wednesday, DM was a perfectly happy 13-month-year-old boy. He might have had a couple sniffles, but that was the extent of his problems. But come Friday and Saturday, this child was acting very different. He was acting lethargic. He couldn't pick up a sippy cup without his arm shaking. Something happened to this child, and that something was explained by the appellant himself. In fact, the appellant explained when asked, "What did you do to this kid?" by the investigator on page 237. He responded with, "I shoved the bottle in his mouth, made sure he banged his head a couple of times. My fault, yeah. I hit his head. And he fell." The appellant stands today claiming that there is no evidence that the appellant hit his head. That is flatly contradicted by the appellant himself in his responses to investigators. He admits that he injured his head. He admits it to the extent that he said, "I made sure he banged his head a couple of times." Therefore, the specification 2 was clearly the evidence before the court was found beyond a reasonable doubt as to specification 2 and his head. Regarding the legs and fracture injuries, I think we should first look, as Judge Rohn indicated before, at what did the appellant do when he was first confronted with this evidence. When he was first confronted with this evidence, his response was, "Okay. People say that you did this. Okay." His next question was, "Did you hurt this child?" And his response is, "Not intentionally." This individual knew what he had done to a 13-month-old boy, and he indicates that over and over again during his hour and 45-minute discussion with the investigator. He explains that he dropped him two or three times. He admits, I did all other things. I bruised his head. When he asked how, he said, well, I dropped him two or three times. That's on page 229 of the record. When asked about his arm, and the question is, we both know you're responsible. His answer is, yeah, maybe his arm, because I was holding him a little hard. He was fighting with me, 13-month-old, fighting with a grown man. This individual, this appellant, knew exactly what he did to this child. He admits to his culpable negligence as well as his intentional actions. He says that he hit his head on my knee. It was significant force because I was being quick about it. In addition to the appellant's own words, we also have the words of the actual child abuse expert in this case. And she testified that this kid had three broken bones, massive bruising to the side of his head, significant, possibly some of the worst oral injury I have ever seen in my child abuse practice. So this wasn't one isolated, accidental injury. Someone beat this kid up in layperson's terms. And your honors can find that on page 466 of the record. The evidence here points to the opportunity and points to the appellant for having committed these crimes. And this court should find that the appellant broke this individual, that the evidence before this court clearly shows that it meets the legal and factual sufficiency standards. And this court should affirm the findings and sentence.
Before you sit down, where do you have any injuries to the leg?
Well, Your Honor, with respect to the leg specifically.
To the leg?
And I know I have about a minute left.
No, he was asking, what did I say?
Oh, to the leg. Okay. With respect to the leg specifically, there is testimony as to by appellant's wife that she saw him have the child in his arms and hit it against the leg. Now, there is some conflicting testimony as to whether or not the experts think that may have caused it. But the appellant himself on page 226 admits that when he dropped him, that his legs were straight and at least one time. And
did he say he landed on his butt?
He said after he landed with the straight legs. I think it's also important to note that there is circumstantial evidence here, and the court and the members could use circumstantial evidence. Unfortunately, the 13-month-old can't testify as to how he got all of these injuries. But the appellant has certainly made clear that he himself knew and understood that he was going to be held accountable for these injuries, and he should be held accountable. And therefore, the government would ask that this court affirm these findings, both factual and legal sufficiency, as well as finding that the appellant received a fair trial because there was no dishonesty here, nor any actual or implied bias. Thank you.
Thank you, members of the court. Members of the court, I'd like to hit on a couple of issues that my opposing counsel raised, and then subject any further questions from the members of the court. Your Honors, the first thing I would like to address is this. There is simply no question that had the defense counsel known that the military magistrate had issued a search authorization with the assistant trial counsel present, that he would have challenged Colonel Cherrick. I think all of us, in our common sense, knowledge of trials and ways of the world, know that to be true. Government counsel states that a military magistrate is not legal training. It's much like ethics training. Again, I would ask you to rely on your experience, knowledge, and ways of the world. How many times have you sat as a counsel and that same question is asked and half the panel members or some of the panels raise up and they say, I've received extra ethics training other than I've served as a contracting officer, I have served as an advisor to the PX or whatever on contracting issues, and I have received ethics training other than what is normally received by the average airman or soldier.
Counsel, can you point to any case law, though, that talks about a magistrate or anything like that where we can look to see if implied bias might be applicable here?
Unfortunately, Your Honor, I can't, and I've tried. And I would suggest that it's probably because when that issue comes up, the challenge is granted because it's such an obvious challenge for cause or implied bias challenge. Now, the other thing that I would like to point out is this, Your Honor. And I believe, Judge, you asked, Judge Haney, you asked a question about the role of the assistant trial counsel. The assistant trial counsel role was not, as I think it's been, I think it's been a little bit of a misconception as to what the assistant trial counsel's role was there. There is no evidence in the record, and again, the military judge did not append a large majority of this information to the record, and we wish he had, but there is no evidence in the record that the assistant trial counsel had anything to do with the military magistrate's training. He may have, he may not have. We simply don't know. What we do know is that the assistant trial counsel was present when the military magistrate was giving a search authorization at the request of another trial counsel. And again, we believe that that relationship would have given grounds for a challenge for cause. Government counsel says the defense has not met their burden in this case. To some degree, whether they're right, if they are correct, it's because we don't have the information we're supposed to have in order to meet that burden. We're being asked to sort of shadow box here with an unknown opponent. When the remedy, should this court believe, and we, again, Your Honors, we believe that there is enough record in this case for this court to say that this challenge would have been granted and that these charges should be reversed. But again, as a fallback position, should this court believe that that is necessary, the defense should at least be in a position of having all of the information that it needs to have in order to make educated decisions with regards to the challenge against Colonel Cherick. The government counsel again points out that a military magistrate is neutral and detached. Yes, that is absolutely correct. We agree with that. A military magistrate also has a burden of proof, a preponderance of the evidence, not beyond a reasonable doubt. That is a significant matter that we believe that the defense counsel would have explored in this case. Your Honor, we believe that either reversal or a limited article post-trial 39A or a debate hearing would be appropriate in this case to at least find out what the extent of that training was. We don't know. There's a very limited amount of information in the record of trial. Whether the assistant trial counsel participated in any way in that training. How many search authorizations did he grant during that time period? We simply don't know the answers to all of these questions. And we're being asked to.
We do know there was no search authorization in this case.
Well, actually, that's not correct, Judge. There was a search authorization. If you recall, a search was conducted of his home, and two pieces of rag or napkins were removed that had blood on them.
Wasn't that done with the mother's consent? I mean, his wife's consent?
But it's still a search of the home.
That's not a search authorization.
Okay, not a search authorization, but it's still a search of the home, something that a military magistrate has a unique knowledge of. And so the military magistrate, again, is given an advantage that your average panel member would not have by knowing how search authorizations work. Why do the police go to your home and ask for a search authorization? Well, I know that that's because they have probable cause that a crime's been committed, and that's the evidence of that crime is going to be found in this locale. Information the other panel members did not have in this case. And, Your Honor, finally, just in my last minute, Your Honor, I would like to address the injury to the head. Government counsel says, well, the accused admitted to it. Actually, that's not true. The accused said that while the child was on the ground, he picked him up and the child hit his knee, banged his head against his knee, which, as pointed out in this case, he was sitting down. He pulled him up on his right side. It would have been the right side of his head that hit the, because it was facing him, it said, right side of his head. The injuries were to the left side of the head. And finally, Your Honors, as it relates to the dropping of the legs, the medical evidence was clear that that could only happen if it was done with extreme force, and we know that the drop in this case was from waist-high level, if not lower, because he was holding the child while sitting down. Subject to any further questions of the court, that concludes my presentation. I thank the court for its attention and its time.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honors.
I'd like to thank counsel for both sides for their oral arguments. They were very helpful and informative, and we're going to have to go back and do some more research here. And we will render a decision in due course. There being no further business before the court today, this court is adjourned.